Hey folks, you're a very good developer. Probably. Regardless, you do write bugs. That's unavoidable. What is avoidable is wasting time trying to track down the cause of those bugs. Sentry.io provides full-stack error tracking that lets you monitor and fix problems in real time. You can see the severity and the scope of the error, get immediate access to the stack trace, connect the problem to the commit that caused it, and fix it without delay. Sentry, it's a name so common that they have to include the top-level domain in their advertising to make sure you remember it. Sentry.io. That's Sentry.io. Open source, full stack, web apps, native apps, mobile games, smart oven mitts. If you can program it, they can make it far easier to fix any errors you encounter with it. Your code may be broken. Let's fix it together. Visit Sentry.io. Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes, and today I'm talking with Dr. Sophia Noble. She's professor at the University of Southern California Annenberg School for Communication, as well as at UCLA's Graduate School of Education and Information Studies. And I found you because I read your book, Algorithms of Oppression, which is a book that you wrote with over 6 years of academic research on Google search algorithms. Thanks so much for talking to me today.
Great to be here.
So this is not the first book you've written, but it's definitely a book that has got a lot of people talking. You went and did research into the power of the algorithms that we use every day to, for something simple, just find a picture or find pizza locally.
I did. You know, I was drawn to this work because I was, kind of serendipitously, I guess you could say, looking for information that might be of interest to my bonus daughter and my nieces. And it really started, this study started with a simple search on the keywords black girls back in about 2010. And I was stunned to find that pornography and hypersexualized content was the primary way that these two keywords together surfaced up content. And that launched me into a multi-year study in looking at all of the ways in which a whole host of things that I think we might not have ever thought about before, particularly when it comes to vulnerable people like children, people of color, sometimes women in our society in the U.S. are misrepresented. And I was thinking about this in the context of other types of information institutions like libraries and schools, and the prominence that search engines are starting to take kind of a bit in their place, and why we might want to pay more attention to what happens in search engines when it comes to representing people, communities, and concepts.
And it seems like there's a lot of, as there are lots of different kinds of people with different educational backgrounds, a lot of different people have different perspectives on what happens when you type a word into a search engine and hit enter. Some people might think that it's curated, that there's a real person. Some people understand the algorithm and are forgiving of it, and others have no idea. It's just magic.
It's true. One of the things we know, for example, is that from the Pew research on search engine users, is that many people think that the things they find in a search engine, especially on the first page, are reliable, are credible, trustworthy. And I think that's mostly because when we look for banal information, like where's the closest Starbucks, for example, or some other kind of fact that's not disputed, search engines can often give us the right answers. So that bolsters our trust. And for a lot of things, they are reliable. But when you start getting to more nuanced, complicated, contested information, when you start thinking about identity and the way in which misinformation or disinformation can be easily manipulated or kind of gamed to the top of the pile of information, I think that's where I'm really interested in thinking about what's at stake and in what ways might that undermine the public really having good, reliable, trustworthy information.
And it makes me wonder also what the correct result would be. Like, we all have a subjective perspective on when we search for something, what we expect to get. We're delighted if it's correct, and we're upset if it's not. Do you solve that by making better algorithms, building different teams, or do you solve it through curation?
It's true. I mean, I'll tell you, one of the things that I was thinking about for the years that I was finding pornography as the primary representation of Black girls, Latina girls, Asian girls, is that I don't think that's the way those communities, those people, those groups of people would represent themselves. And of course, these are, you know, in this case of those examples, we're talking about children and adolescents who don't have a lot of money, who don't understand that Google search is primarily an advertising engine, right? It's those who have a lot of capital, and there's a lot of research to kind of bear this out. People with and organizations with the most money are often able to take advantage of, let's say, AdWords, and helping to make their content more visible. And in the case of the pornography industry, you know, you didn't really even have to add the words sex or porn or pornography to make Black girls, Asian girls, Latina girls synonymous with porn. And so those are the kinds of things that I think people are less aware of as part of the way in which powerful industries and organizations really have a lot more ability to have their version of Black girls represented, maybe than African American or Black or Latina girls themselves. And those are the kinds of power dynamics that I'm really interested in studying.
This is the focus of your book, and it's called Algorithms of Oppression, using this search term as an example for underrepresented groups. Does this apply to any result that is an undesirable result? Any term that I might search for, that whether it be like I might search for, I have no idea, I haven't searched for it yet, but like, you know, Americans, and then Google says are dumb, or, you know, so and so actor that I might like is, and then it starts to autocomplete, is an idiot, is whatever. When are these things correct, and when are they not, and when are they problematic, and when are they not?
Well, I think, you know, this has been one of the issues that's been in the headlines here quite recently. For example, you know, how Google auto-suggests certain ideas, you know, whether the word idiot, let's say, gets paired up with a politician or someone in the White House or that kind of thing. And these are, you know, of course, the new conversations that we're having are about particular types of bias, whether there are certain kinds of political bias, right, around search engine results. And I think that, you know, this is a new opening that heretofore there was a high degree of trust, not even a questioning of whether there was a particular slant or bias happening in search. Now, I think certainly with my book and other investigative journalists and people like yourself who are opening up the conversation, it's allowing us to say, well, what are the primary influences in a commercial search engine? What's at stake, and how is that different for different people? And certainly, I think that celebrities and political figures, you know, there's a long history of having their names kind of associated with unfavorable content. But those are people who have a lot of power in our society, celebrities and politicians. I think much more is at stake for people who are vulnerable, who don't have influence, who aren't millionaires, who don't have the ability, for example, to affect public policy. What's happening for them, and what kind of bias is in place? And we see this, for example, around immigration. You know, there's kind of, you know, negative south of the border types of conversations that come up and kind of dominate in search engines about the, you know, a word like that. So there's certainly kind of a set of politics that you might say that are popular and that circulate. And in some ways, I think what's a challenge is that the public relates to search engines as a bit of a truth teller, like that it will give them facts, and it's less, the public is less likely to understand that there are all kinds of influences happening around what they may see. And those are the things that I think are worth talking about.
Mm-hmm. One of the phrases that you use in the book that I really like, and I think I'm going to start using all the time, is this concept of algorithmic literacy. I didn't think that anyone needed that, but do you think that this is something that should be taught, that the idea that one should be conscious of an algorithm, know what it is, that it exists, and that it may not necessarily give them what they want?
Well, I definitely think that we are moving into an era in our kind of society where people may not understand the very complex mathematical formulations that mm-hmm. undergird the algorithms that they're engaging with every day in all kinds of different, let's say, apps that they're using on their phones or, you know, at work and at play. They may not understand the math of it. And in mm-hmm. many cases, the algorithm is, you know, it's black boxed. You can't see it. It's proprietary. It's a trade secret. But they certainly should understand how to evaluate the output of these systems and what they might mean, rather than, I think, blindly trusting that there are no power dynamics or no effects that, you know, could be manipulated in a way to get a whole host of answers or solutions. And ultimately, mm-hmm. I think with many of the algorithms that we're engaging with, the very first motivation is a profit motive. And so whether it's collecting data on us as we use these applications and these algorithms, or whether it's feeding back a very, you know, consumeristic set of propositions for us, our literacy is really important. And I think one of the things that I try to stress in my work is that the more we let algorithms make decisions for us, rather than using kind of our own critical thinking and our own ideas, our own kind of human subjectivities, I think the more we lose a sense of being able to participate in our own decision-making that affects ourselves, our families, and our communities.
Yeah, I think that's a really significant point that you're making. And I'm seeing it in my young sons that I'm raising, that they are taking things for granted and they're taking autocomplete as gospel, for to mix my metaphors a little bit. My 13-year-old was like, "Hey, I've got this thing in the back of my head. Is it cancer or whatever?" And he had been looking, you know, something he typed in like brain or head or something, and then it was like might be cancer, autocomplete or something. And it was like, "Well, no, like use your critical thinking." He's like, "Well, doesn't Google know all these things?" Well, no. Your common sense is as important or more so than anything Google could give you. And it was really surprising.
Right. Yes. Yeah. Well, you know, I work in a university and I've been teaching university students now for some time. And I will tell you that many of my students say they could never graduate from college without Google. Google's the first place they go to help them write papers, you know, think mm-hmm. through ideas. And one of the ways I challenge them is I say, listen, you know, you've gone through 12 years of education, K through 12. Now you're in a university for a few years. And there are many vantage points that you could take up looking at any particular phenomenon or object. And we spend time, years, cultivating a complex way of thinking. Not all questions can be answered in 0.03 seconds. In fact, there are many forms of knowledge and ideas that are heavily contested, have been contested for, you know, thousands of years. Mm-hmm. So what we seed in our own acculturation to algorithms is this idea of, you know, an instant answer, that everything can be known, that it's fixed, and that we don't have a say, that, you know, the machine is dictating to us what the answer is. And I think that you know, that is not the way you want to educate people in a democracy. You want people to have high levels of literacy, be very well educated, and not just kind of function as a dumb box where, you know, the machine gives you an answer. And I think we're losing something. We're putting something at stake in our human education when we kind of move to these new processes.
Yeah, it seems that the heat gets turned up on the stove a little bit at a time. My wife noticed recently that I'm using the GPS for basically everything, even places that I know darn well how to get to. And she always chastises me for trusting the GPS and not trusting my own common sense.
Well, you know, this is certainly important. And some of the things that we know, for example, about mapping technologies is that often maps will route us through certain neighborhoods, not route us through other neighborhoods. I think there was recently some stories about Uber drivers, for example, going through affluent neighborhoods and people not liking apps like Waze, taking them through, you know, affluent, again, neighborhoods that don't want to see a lot of traffic down their streets, but also conversely, not going into certain neighborhoods that maybe have been programmed or deemed somehow by the algorithm to be quote unquote bad neighborhoods. So, you know, these things are really interesting to me. And I think I find it fascinating to sit and think about these things, to research them and to talk about them. And when I talk to other people, they often scratch their head and they're like, you know, I never really thought about that. And maybe I should rethink my over-reliance upon, you know, where I'm being directed. And I think, again, you know, this conversation is really interesting to think about what might be at stake in concretizing and making even more real these ideas that some neighborhoods, which of course we often know are like neighborhoods where a lot of people of color live or poor communities, are quote unquote the bad places and not the good places. And I think people are studying how apps are reinforcing some of these ideas too.
This episode is sponsored by Stack Overflow for Teams, a private, secure home for your team's questions and answers. It's everything that you love about Stack Overflow, now for your company. Get instant, reliable answers from your coworkers without disrupting them. Unlike documentation or wikis, long email threads, or distracting instant messages, Q&A mimics the way that we naturally share and find information. Introduce Stack Overflow for Teams to your company and start building products faster and better. Visit s.tk/Hanselminutes to get your first month free. That's s.tk/Hanselminutes. What do you say for people who might be listening and might be thinking that, oh gosh, you know, she's making this all about color or all about politics. I don't want color in my neutral computerized artificial intelligence. I want it just to simply be neutral.
Well, you know, there's such a strong set of ideas in our society that technology is neutral. I mean, this is, I'm not the first person to kind of question whether that's true or not. I will say that I've had a lot of computer scientists over the years, students in my classes. And one of the things that I find interesting is that after 3 or 4 or 5 years of an engineering education, I mean, these are very smart students, many of whom have AP tested in high school out of English, out of their humanities courses. They're not taking history or any social science or humanities courses at the university level. They're in a strict kind of math and engineering education. And I often say to them, how much confidence do you feel about designing technology for society when you really have not studied society at the, you know, university level now? And, often I find that the kinds of books and articles that I ask them to read about the impact of technology in society are things they've never been exposed to. And they find themselves, you know, in some ways, I think, feeling ill-prepared and incredibly responsible for the kinds of products they're going to be designing for people. And they really have never thought about any adverse effects. So, you know, I often say, and I say in the book, that an interdisciplinary, well-rounded kind of preparation for engineering students is really crucial, because I think that there's always kind of a set of intended outcomes and there are often a set of unintended outcomes. And the more you know about history and society and people, the more you can kind of be prepared to address some of the unintended consequences. And even Silicon Valley executives now will often see that they are thinking about ethics now, thinking about the disparate impact of their products. But I think it's been people like myself and others who have raised some criticisms that have helped the industry rethink some of its practices. And I think overall, that's a great thing.
One of the things that I appreciated particularly about your book was that you stated something very simply, that search results are more than simply what is popular, but somehow people are using objective and neutral, and you're using it as a synonym for popular.
Yes. Well, you know, you can find something that's popular in society and it may or may not be true. So we know this, right? Irrespective of whether we're using technology or not, that many things that are popular are not positive for society or are misrepresentative. Stereotypes, for example, about mm-hmm. all kinds of groups can be wildly popular. It doesn't actually mean they're true or helpful in terms of having kind of the kind of fair society maybe that we want to have for everyone. So I mm-hmm. think, you know, many times the challenge here is that people use search engines as if they're, let's say, an online library, right? And so the kinds of things you might find in a library would be a big context. And I'll tell you, I give this exercise to my students. I'll say, you know, go to a library database and look up any topic you care about, anyone, mm-hmm. it doesn't matter. You pick something. And then go to the stacks of books and find that book that you're looking for. And then come back and tell me something about the context within which you found it. And so they'll often find like, wow, you know, this subject I was looking for, let's say, you know, they are looking for something about LGBTQ identity, but they find it in a big context of books about sexual deviance. And that tells them something about the way in which for a long time we've seen sexual identity, right? In this very scientific, clinical, psychological sense. And then they see that that's a point of view, kind of a subjective point of view that has a long history, but that there's a lot more to it. And now in a search engine, you're not going to find a context for finding that those things that come to the front page. You're not going to be able to see what's influencing the subjective nature of the thing that you're looking for. And so even in the book, I propose kind of other metaphors and other ways of making information context much more available and visible to us. Again, rather than just assuming that the things we find are an absolute truth, I think we need mm-hmm. to know more about the things we're looking for and what might be influencing why we're finding them.
It seems like early versions of the Google algorithm pre-2007 were a lot more well understood than the giant black box. It was quite a less sophisticated algorithm in the past. And there was this notion of Google bombing, where you could get enough people to quote something and you could basically prank the internet. So you'd go and search for French military victories and you'd click, I'm feeling lucky. And suddenly you'd find yourself on a fake version of Google that says, did you mean French military defeats? And that's cute up to a point until you realize you can entirely game the system and put falsities in front of searches for truth.
Well, we know this happens quite a bit. And, you know, in the early days, I mean, I've been on the internet for a long time. And, you know, we used to have, how we found information was we had a lot of expert communities who might organize, you know, bodies of information. You could go into parts, you know, kind of the bulletin board system of the internet and find people, ask for expertise. There might've been people who really were teachers or experts in an area. You know, when we moved to this kind of white opaque page, mm-hmm. Where you could put in a search term and then kind of trust that the mechanics or the logics behind it were going to give you the best thing. We removed a layer of kind of, again, understanding that there might be many points of view and many experts involved in helping us find what we're looking for. So now we have a whole generation of people who have never experienced that kind of library-esque mm-hmm. type of search and have moved to this rather opaque type of search. And I think, you know, we know that there are people and organizations who often try to game the system. Mm-hmm. There was a great story, and by great, I mean terrible, story in The Guardian a few months ago about how white nationalists had taken over Boasian anthropology. And of course, we've seen white power and white pride organizations take over different kinds of keywords that would lead people to Holocaust denial sites, right? Just flat out disinformation sites. And I think those are the kinds of things that, again, are very difficult to see. You really don't know that's happening. And you know, every once in a while, the news media will pick up, for example, stories about students writing papers on Dr. King and, you know, providing a lot of really terrible misinformation, disinformation about Dr. King, you know, and what they find is that Stormfront and other organizations have been able to co-opt Dr. King's name on the internet and basically try to discredit civil rights and the civil rights movement. Mm-hmm. So I think those are the kinds of things. These are very, like, I think it's fairly uncontested in our modern democracy in 2019 that the civil rights movement was probably a good thing for our society. And yet we still find people who fall into these crevices of the web where they're led to really harmful, hateful, anti-democratic information. Mm-hmm. And I think those are things we should, you know, we should definitely care about, especially as our kids are engaging with this content, often quite unsupervised.
Yeah. In your book, you talk about, since you work in academia and you think about things in a scholarly way with other scholars, you talk about the importance of citations. You know, I spent all those years in school and in college with footnotes for everything and citing papers so that you had a web of trust, but that web of trust doesn't seem to scale to the actual web.
Well, you know, in the early days of Google in particular, but I don't think just Google, you know, this idea of hyperlinking to other sites was a way of signaling credibility and mm-hmm. trustworthiness in search. And so if I had a site and a lot of people were linking to it and pointing to it and saying, you should go to, you know, Sophia Noble's site, then, you know, that's something you can trust. That was something that was available to us as a kind of practice of citation that was quite frankly borrowed from the field of library and information science. You know, what scholars do. Now you have other kinds of imperatives like purchasing keywords and trying to optimize content. And we have a huge gray industry of search engine optimization and advertising companies that spend, you know, millions and millions of dollars trying to optimize their content to the first page, mostly because most people don't go past the first page when they're using search engines. So what lands there is incredibly important. And Google and big commercial search engine platforms are always trying to, you know, keep their own algorithms from being kind of subverted by this SEO industry. So mm-hmm. now you have, according to, you know, Google's own search lab, over 200 different factors that go into helping kind of their AI decide, you know, what to bring to the first page. And oftentimes mm-hmm. one of the things you'll find is that large advertisers, large, you know, the clients of theirs are show up on the first page. It's why when we look for certain, for example, news, we're probably going to be led to very large news organizations rather than, say, a teeny local, you know, campus, university campus newspaper or some very small community paper, right? We're going to find mm-hmm. the large platforms. So that kind of, you know, same with, you know, for years of, you know, if you're looking for women's clothing, you're going to be led mostly to, you know, large, you know, companies that spend a lot of money to be made visible around women's clothing. So ultimately, you know, it's advertising that is driving search engines, not necessarily a quest for truth or curated, cited, you know, trustworthy information, which might be something that you find more so in a library. And I think Google search is excellent for commercial content. You know, when you're looking to buy products and services, it's very good for that. Or if you're looking for, you know, certain types of undisputed facts, you know, it might send you to Wikipedia first. But in many cases, it's it can be quite deceiving whether you should trust, you know, advertising as a primary, you know, source of information for making good decisions.
Mm-hmm. And you point out something very interesting that I think children should understand is that they think that Google and that search engines are part of the internet. They are synonymous for the internet, and they are treated almost as a public utility. But they have interests. They are a company that need to keep the lights on. So as such, you need to kind of take those Google results and put them in context. And that's asking a lot because we search dozens of times a day.
It's true. And, you know, even with my own family, you know, I find my second grader saying, well, Mom, why don't we just Google it? And, you know, of course, he doesn't know his mom has just kind of really written this book, you know, offering up a set of alternatives to just Googling it all the time. And I say, well, why don't you instead, if you're interested in that topic, why don't you talk to your librarian at school? Or why don't you ask your teacher about it? Why don't you call your grandparents? You know, why don't you get multiple points of view? You know, grandparents might know something about that because they were alive during that time or they were young during that time. Do you know, like even in my own home, I have to, you know, try to teach my son out of some of those habits because I want him to kind of learn that there are other ways of knowing besides just going to a search engine. And I think that, you know, again, a lot is to be learned and, you know, society and ideas, they're complex. And, you know, one of the things that I offer up as a kind of in the conclusion of the book is that, you know, I don't think the answer is, getting rid of Google. I actually think more competition, more search engines, more investment in public libraries, public media, public education, public universities is really kind of serves as the right way to bolster our democracy. It's not that commercial search engines don't have a role to play that can be helpful in sorting through a lot of what's on the internet. But I think to cede so much of our educational space and our knowledge space to advertising platforms is probably not in the best interest of having a well-informed democracy. And so those are the kinds of things that I really try to argue for is that, you know, it's not just enough to have public policy and regulation around big tech firms, social media, artificial intelligence firms, but we also have to bolster that with deeper investments in more democratic knowledge institutions like libraries.
So as we reach the conclusion of this show, let me ask you one final somewhat loaded question. Now that it's 2019, and if we go to Google Images and we search for black girls or white girls or Asian girls, we see largely positive representations that appear to me to be from the rise of positivity and user generated content. There's a lot of very enthusiastic beauty bloggers and people blogging about, you know, pretty this and beauty that and positive this and these people rock and those people rock. Are we affecting Google? Did we the community of positivity affect them, or did they change their algorithm, or both?
I think it's both. I think I can tell you that as I've seen kind of my own critiques get more traction and visibility, and other scholars who are and people on social media and journalists are saying, hey, wait a minute, big tech companies, these aren't fair representations, just like other mass media of the past, television and radio, kind of demands for better representation. I see tech companies responding quietly in their own ways to tweaking their algorithms and putting more people kind of on the case of caring about these things. And so I think it's a bit of a symbiotic relationship between the public and critics and also people who work in those companies. I know a lot of people who work in tech companies who care deeply about these issues and who are also inside those companies saying, hey, we need to do better. We need to care about misrepresentative information in the search engine. We need to care about disinformation and hate information and hate speech in social media. And I think there are, you know, we're at a point now where we can be in more open conversations finally about what's at stake when we aren't having the conversations. And I see that as progress for sure.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for chatting with me today.
You're welcome. Thanks for the invitation.
You can learn all about Safiya's work at Safiya U Noble. I'll put a link in the show notes, and you can read her book as well as her other books and other expertise and research as we explore these topics. This has been another episode of Hansel Mats, and we'll see you again next week.